This is The Takeaway for Tuesday, January 31st, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And U.S. airports are beginning to resemble terminals in Nairobi, Cairo, and Istanbul today as attorneys, translators, and immigration activists set up shop with their computers, folding tables, and typewriters to aid incoming passengers faced with new paperwork uncertainties about entering the U.S. In his first public statement since the inauguration, former President Barack Obama has come out against President Trump's order. Senate Democrats have introduced a bill to undo it. It restricts people from mostly Muslim countries from entering the United States. Do Republicans think this order is ready for prime time?
We still are seeking some clarity, and my guess is over the next couple of days there'll be additional clarifications and clarity as to what's happening. We know there's still a lot of confusion around the world as to what this means.
That's Senator Bob Corker speaking with The Takeaway's Todd Zwillick. According to The Washington Post, Corker is one of more than 60 Republican representatives and senators who have expressed reservations or declined to fully support the immigration ban, while more than 80 support it. Now, we should note that for declining to defend it in public, the acting attorney general was fired. Congressman Leonard Lance has served as a Republican representative from New Jersey's 7th District since 2009. Where do you stand on this, Congressman?
It's a pleasure to be with you, John. I do think that the executive order needs clarification, and I stated over the weekend that I thought that more work needs to be done. I understand the purpose of the president, but, for example, I do not think it should affect green card holders.
And you described it as rushed and poorly implemented. Would you support a bipartisan effort to help the president understand that, you know, there's a reason why Congress and the executive, you know, write legislation and work together on these sorts of things?
Absolutely. And I think we should move forward in a bipartisan capacity. And I understand.
So let me just clarify. You would vote with Democrats on something like that?
I don't think that a Democratic proposal would likely come before the House of Representatives, but I certainly want to work with our own leadership, Speaker Ryan and others, to make sure that there is an understanding in the executive branch, 2.2 miles west of us down Pennsylvania Avenue, that there should have been greater consultation. And certainly, I think, John, as well, that the president should have involved his Secretary of Defense and his Secretary of Homeland Security in this matter.
Let alone the Secretary of State and all of those people found out about this in the media, including Bob Corker, your colleague there in the Senate.
Now, regarding the Secretary of State, I hope that the Senate will act in an expeditious manner in confirmation of the Secretary of State. And I know that that is proceeding. But, of course, the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of Homeland Security are already in place.
Indeed. And I guess there's some reason to expedite getting Jeff Sessions over to the Department of Justice, given what's happened with Sally Yates. Listen to Senator Sessions questioning Sally Yates during her confirmation hearing back in March of 2015. There's a little bit of irony here, but I want to discuss it with you.
Like any CEO with a law firm, sometimes the lawyers have to tell the CEO, Mr. CEO, you can't do that. Don't do that. We'll get us sued. No matter how headstrong they might be. Do you feel like that's the duty of the Attorney General's office?
I do believe that that's the duty of the Attorney General's office, to fairly and impartially evaluate the law and to provide the president and the administration with impartial legal advice.
Do you believe, as the president has suggested in a tweet, that Sally Yates was weak on the border, betrayed the White House in some way in this termination?
I'm an attorney, and as an attorney, I try to give clients the best legal advice possible. And I believe that that was probably the situation here, if indeed Sally Yates was involved at all in the matter. I do think it points out that Senator Sessions should be confirmed as quickly as possible, and then he can give his advice as the duly confirmed Attorney General of the United States. Sally Yates was a holdover from the Obama administration, and I think that that was appropriate, but I would hope that the Senate would act expeditiously on the confirmation of Senator Sessions.
Indeed. And based on that audio clip that you just heard, I mean, it's conceivable. I mean, I don't know this. You maybe know Senator Sessions better than I do, that there may be some admiration there from Senator Sessions for Sally Yates, and that we need some of that, you know, constraint in the Department of Justice to prevent this sort of chaos from happening here. I'm not being critical of Trump, but we do want things to settle down, right?
I certainly think we should move forward, and all incoming administrations have fits and starts. And I can recall the beginning of the Obama administration regarding Guantanamo, for example, the beginning of the Clinton administration back in 1993. I think all administrations have to get their sea legs, but I want those sea legs gotten as quickly as possible.
What do you make of these executive order sessions with the little crowd behind the president signing things that maybe people who aren't as well versed in what an executive order is versus what a bill signing is versus what an actual law is versus what a vote in Congress is, giving the impression that the president is actually legislating from the Oval Office. Do you think it's appropriate? I mean, I understand what the photo op is there, but it feels a little separation of powers. You know, a little makes me a little bit nervous. How about you?
Often in public policy, where you stand is where you sit. John and I sit in the legislative branch of government here on Capitol Hill, the first branch of government under Article 1, and I would hope that the president would consult with us. And certainly some of these matters ultimately require legislation, not executive orders. Other of his executive orders have traditionally occurred in the past. For example, the LGBTQ executive order of this morning is based upon an executive order of President Obama. The Mexico City executive order is based upon what Republican presidents have done in the past. But regarding the immigration issue, which I think is the one in controversy, or at least in the most controversy, ultimately I hope and expect that the White House will work with us on Capitol Hill regarding legislation in this area. I have previously voted for legislation, and it did not pass in the Senate, however. And I expect a relationship between the two elected branches of government and greater consultation, at the very least, with those of us, particularly our leadership, who serve here on Capitol Hill.
You have heard that Senator Rubio tried to get some advice from the U.S. State Department on the immigration order and was refused. You talked about consultation a moment ago. What does that say to you about a need for maybe more clarity as far as opening the lines of communication here?
I think there should be open lines of communications, and what Senator Corker said, as you quoted Senator Corker, I agree with that. And of course, Senator Rubio is involved with that committee as well. I certainly agree with the chairman of the committee over in the Senate, and I expect that there will be greater lines of communications as we move forward, given the first actions here in the first 10 days of the administration.
Do you think there is a gentle way, in a bipartisan way, using the leadership in the House and the Senate, people like Bob Corker, and just sort of draft something that says to President Trump, we like where you're headed, but this is a better way of doing things? Could something like that happen and pass and not be perceived as some sort of insurrection?
I think that's possible. I would hope that my colleagues on the Democratic side would not politicize this matter. I think that we have to move forward to protect the homeland to the greatest extent possible. The seven countries that were mentioned were countries that were identified by President Obama and his administration. I do not believe that the national security and protection of the homeland are partisan issues. I think that we should work in a bipartisan capacity. And I want the Secretary of State to be in place as soon as possible. I understand the Secretary of Defense is traveling abroad later this week. But as the two principal cabinet officers in this regard, along with the Secretary of Homeland Security, for example, I think that they should come up to the Hill to be involved in consultations with us. And we also should recognize that the president has responsibilities under the Constitution to make sure that the American people are safe and secure.
Congressman Leonard Lance of New Jersey's 7th District has served as a Republican in the U.S. House since 2009. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you very much, John.
Capitol Hill is following every machination of this executive order, but what are the feelings in the center of the country where change is slow and people are loyal? In fact, some people live in Loyal, about 70 miles northwest of Oklahoma City. It's a town, a little town in Kingfisher County, 81 residents, and two of them are Clay Pope and his mother, Jacqueline.
Bill and I were married for 57 years. He taught school for the first 10 years we were married while he was farming. And then he retired to full-time farming. And it's been wheat and cattle. And
I was getting ready to say we've got about 2,600 acres. And it's primary wheat and beef operation now. We've always had wheat. We used to milk dairy cows too. But production agriculture and making the income off of the land for mom and my brother have always been their only sources of income, especially until after dad quit teaching for a little while. But then I've come back to the farm and I helped some, but I've had off farm income during the time since I came back about 1993, 94.
We didn't have family vacations. We've never been to Disneyland or anything like that. We were home. We worked, and it takes work. I've been places and people say, well, I don't think I'm going to get Christmas Eve off. Well, if I don't get Christmas Eve off, I'm going to have New Year's Eve off. We work 7 days a week, 52 weeks out of the year. It's not quite as bad since we quit dairying, but it's still. And you can plan to go someplace, that darn herd of cattle will get out, and you don't get to go. Your plans are changed. I mean, it's a different life.
Well, I can't tell you a little joke about that. Mom mentioned dairy. And of course, I grew up with mom and dad milking cows and then milk cows some, too. And I can always the playpen in the dairy barn, and that was always the joke that if you're gonna die, you got to wait until the milking's done. and we actually had a neighbor not too far from us that they were dairying too, and I think her water actually broke. She had to wait till she got the milkers clean before she could go to the hospital. So that's when she went into labor. So that's just some of the stories that you do. I can remember one of the earliest memories that I have is you tying me on a tractor. Yep. With a piece of rope. We had an 0830 John Deere. We
didn't have
a cab
on
it. And that's what you tied me on there as a little kid. I was probably about 2 years old, and you were
a little bit older.
And that's what, so I wouldn't fall off the tractor when you were out working in the fields.
That's one thing about farm life. It's you're together. You work together all the time. You have to.
They see a divided America on both coasts. Their responsibility remains getting from this land all that it will give for them and for all of us, too. For more than a century, wheat crops and cattle. Oh, and these days, one more thing.
That's always the joke, is that if you got an oil well, it makes you a heck of a lot better farmer. And so, the natural resources has always been the base of the wealth in this part of the country. And that's been a combination of both the mineral rights and what comes with oil and gas production. And then, of course, the production on the surface of the land. Cattle has been a big part of the income stream in this part of the world. Also, wheat. And when I say wheat, it's winter wheat. That's what's called dual purpose wheat. It's wheat that you plant and you can graze livestock on in the wintertime. You pull them off around March, and then it goes ahead and heads on out, and you can cut that for grain.
Is it hard to make a living off the land these days as a family farmer? Can you hold on to the land and make a living?
We have so far, but equipment is getting so outlandish that, you know, trying to make the payment each year just on tractors, and right now we're looking at maybe a combine, $140,000 for a used combine, and I've already got the header. You know, it's just the combine.
Well, and that's what we had tractor go south on us this year, and when we end up paying for that tractor at the dealership we just built, and it's, how old is that tractor? It's a used tractor.
Yeah.
And I was getting ready to say it was.
Well, that's a combine will be too.
Yeah, I was getting ready to say.
So you absolutely can't afford new equipment. I just don't see how.
You know, we've been able to make a go of it. And, of course, obviously, the another thing that we've seen a benefit from in this area is that we are probably in the last part of the United States where they've been aggressively pursuing oil and gas. We're in what's called the stack area. Companies that had money already invested in drilling and had made those capital expenses, they've moved a lot of those resources into this area because it's proven reserves, relatively easy to get to. And there's been a lot of, that's helped. Like I said earlier about you've got a good oil well, it makes you a lot better farmer. We've been lucky.
Fair.
I was getting ready to say we've been lucky, and that's helped out quite a bit.
Every election, it's about what is America, you know. who is America? And everybody has an answer for that. But from your perspective, how has that changed or how has it stayed the same?
It seems like that we haven't got enough number for them to even care about so much of the time in politics because there's fewer and fewer farmers. When I was growing up, there was a family on every quarter of land. And now you go for miles and you won't find a home. And we're just getting fewer and fewer, but you know that food's got to come from somewhere.
We are described as a divided country in America. What could change that, do you think?
I honestly don't know. The main thing is we've got so far away from faith. If you believe in everybody around you, it's not so bad. But it's just got that everybody's just, they don't have time for anybody else, not even their families. So I think that's one of the things, just not getting to know people. You know, we all have basically the same heart. When I was growing up, you know, we would have families in. We'd play cards. Nowadays, it's computer or else we're on that darn phone all the time.
You know, you think about it that, you know, of course, we still have an active Lions Club down here, but it's not everybody in the community like it used to be. It's kind of drying off, too. But you don't have that, and Mom said faith, but whether it's church or whether it's something like the Lions Club or whether it's, you know, a community group, just anybody. The thing is that you can disagree, but you're not evil. You know what I'm saying? People may be wrong, but they're not bad. But we've gotten to this point where if you don't talk to people that you disagree with, that you're, you know, just understand that we're going to sometimes have different opinion. But everybody, like Mom said, we're all human. I mean, we're all in this together. We're all part of, we should be part of the same family or the same community, whether you're talking about the country, whether you're talking about your city, whether you're talking about your state, whatever it is. And that's one of the big things that we've lost, because if you don't believe like I do, I'm not talking to you, I'm not listening to you, and it's been, and people for their own, in my opinion, in their own interest, has pushed this concept that if you disagree with me, you're not just wrong, you're evil. Now, I can agree, I can get along with somebody who's wrong, but if somebody's evil, I got to fight them with everything I got. And I think that's when one of the big disconnections that we see that's really made, it's really made a lot of things hard in our country, but our politics especially.
8 years ago, first African-American president. Wow, what a huge change in American life. What does that mean? And today, it's Donald Trump. What do you make of that contrast?
It's a change. Our life didn't change that much out here. Our life didn't change that much, and I don't think it'll change that much again. We've lived in this country with nuts before, and we will again. I mean, whichever side you want to fall on, we'll survive. We'll survive.
I think like any other president, Obama did some things right, and he did some things wrong. And I anticipate that President Trump, like any other president, will do some things right and do some things wrong.
They're only human.
And there's more to the game than just the president. I think there's a responsibility of Congress to do their job. You know, are they going to represent their constituents? You know, you've got the courts that serve as another check. You know, you've got the states. You know, how is it all going to fit together? I mean, you can't put everything, good or bad, on one individual, nor should you expect to. That's not how the system's supposed to work.
I think Donald Trump's going to find out that he can't do everything. You know, he just can't. He's a human being, believe it or not. We've got to check and balance government, and it'll work out.
Faith in the U.S. government from some Democrats, Jacqueline Pope and her son Clay Pope from You Can't Make This Up, Loyal, Oklahoma, 81 residents. I spoke to them last week. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Perhaps the same people that applauded a Muslim immigration ban promised by Donald Trump during the campaign were maybe thrilled with this Trump promise as well.
Let me ask you, should I keep the Twitter going or not? Keep it going? I think so.
At one of the inaugural balls, the president underscored his favorite mode of communication that may actually be more of a security risk than breaches at the border. At the president's insistence, Donald Trump's tweets reportedly come from a private Android phone in the White House that may make him an easy target for hackers. Jamil Jaffer is director of the Homeland and National Security Law Program at the Scalia Law School of George Mason University. Jamil, welcome to The Takeaway.
John, thanks for having me.
How serious, how vulnerable is this tweet Android issue here?
Well, you know, John, I mean, you can make these phones more secure But, you know, the media reporting on this has at least been that that President Trump's phone is fairly insecure. And so that's obviously a concern. You don't want any device that the president has in his possession to be insecure because of all the information that may be on it and access that device may give you to other devices that he may plug it into or connect it to.
And he joked during the campaign that his young son is better at him than these kinds of, you know, encryption skills that would be required to use such a phone. How hard is it to use a fully encrypted phone in the way that Trump likes to do it off the cuff?
Well, you know, I mean, encryption's gotten better over time and more and easier to use. To be sure, it's still kludgy and difficult. I have encrypted email on my phone. It's a pain to use, to be honest. But there are capabilities that are getting better day by day. And of course, you know, the president has access to all manner of agencies that can help him work on securing his phone, from the in-house White House communications shop, you know, to all the professionals at NSA and FBI.
All right. So as it stands now, this is a security risk, not unlike the kinds of security risks that the border immigration bans and restrictions are attempting to address. Any comment on what's been going on with the firing over at DOJ, the chaos apparently at some of the airports?
Well, I mean, I think it is astounding that, you know, just 10 days into the administration, we've seen some very big, bold moves by the president, the White House. As might be expected, there is some confusion. You know, the president signed this executive order. DHS implemented it one way without applying to green card holders. The White House very quickly moved, apparently, to ensure the green card holders were covered. And then the very next day had to walk it back. And so, you know, obviously a lot of confusion about implementation. And then you add on to it the confusion coming out of the Justice Department, where ostensibly the Office of Legal Counsel reviewed the order as to form and legality. The Attorney General then turned around and said she wouldn't enforce it. And the president's reaction, kind of in an amazing, you know, sort of shocking to a lot of people, move to remove the Attorney General from her position and to replace her with, you know, a well-known and well-regarded federal prosecutor out of Virginia. You know, a crazy couple of days. And just sort of very surprising moves, you know, just 10 days in this administration.
Jamil Joffre, if it keeps going on like this, a lot of your students are going to be recruited by the ACLU, right?
Well, I mean, I think we'll see them recruited by the ACLU, by the White House, by outside groups, you know, Capitol Hill. I mean, lawyers are going to be in hot demand if this kind of stuff continues forward on a going forward basis, for sure.
Jamil Joffre is director of the Homeland and National Security Law Program at the Scalia Law School of George Mason University. He's a visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution. He spoke with us from Arlington, Virginia. Jamil, thanks so much.
John, thanks so much for having me.
President Trump has other people to worry about his privacy online. Ordinary people don't. But even if we wanted to, what a headache. According to Pew Research, 74% of Americans say being in control of who gets your information is important, yet people continue to sign up for free services at Amazon, on Facebook, living large and under the digital spotlight. This privacy paradox is being tackled by the irreplaceable Manoush Zomorodi, the host of WNYC's Note to Self. She's giving listeners who sign up a series of challenges to teach how one can restore privacy without retreating to the mountain cabin. Manoush says we have to get engaged.
I think right now we say, okay, well, whatever I put on Facebook, it's fine that they can see this. But there are so many other things that we don't know that they're tracking. We know now that there are over 50,000 categories that Facebook puts us in. One of those categories is called ethnic affinity. This means that advertisers can decide who or who doesn't see their ads. They also are...
Manoush, that's a weird name.
Well, exactly. So, that's exactly
so
right.
You're out of... God knows you're being excluded from.
Well, that's exactly right. And I think, you know, we can laugh and say, oh, I didn't get a good deal on my shoes that I wanted to get. But as we see now, people protesting at airports across the country, and we hear that they were asking people coming into the United States, asking to see their social media profiles, asking for their online address books. At what point does this start to become much more serious, less about shopping and more about civil rights?
And no-fly lists and that sort of thing.
Precisely.
Is it possible that privacy, though, gets in the way of things like tracking public health? Privacy gets in the way of things like knowing about the electorate, knowing about, you know, broad aspects of your community that it would be better to know rather than not know?
Well, I think that is a false dichotomy. People say like, well, you can't have the good stuff if you don't also have the bad. That is absolutely not the case. Having spoken to numerous technologists, Tim Berners-Lee, the man who invented the World Wide Web, we are at a point where we don't have to go down this road to get the good parts of data to potentially solve cancer or figure out how to control climate change that we can't.
Communicable diseases?
All those things. I mean, yes, you do need big data for this, but that doesn't mean that we have to hand over our personal privacy as well.
If your program here is the privacy paradox, mm-hmm. let's retake our privacy. Isn't the horse already out of the barn? I mean, isn't are you retaking privacy or are you retaking the illusion of privacy in what you're doing?
Yeah. Well, I think the horse is standing at the doorway.
Okay.
And right now, I've got this sugar cube in my hand and I am going to lure him back into the barn. I don't know where I'm going with this metaphor, but John, I do want to tell you what we have is a 5-part plan. And our goal is to help people learn more about where their information goes online. Right now, there is not a lot of transparency. We need to push for that. We want them to weigh the trade-offs that they make every time they sign up for a free service.
And that's understand the fine print and understand the trade-offs.
Correct. Right? So, for example, Uber, it now tracks your movements at all times if you have the app. Is that okay? Some people who are taking Uber to protest say, no, maybe that's not okay because that might be a problem. So just to let you know, like some of our listeners have told us quite extraordinary stories. One man told us his religious wife filed for divorce after Facebook changed its settings and revealed to her that he belonged to an atheist group. Another listener told us how upsetting it was to see fertility ads following her around online after she did research for ovarian surgery that she needed. People saw their emails in WikiLeaks dumps. Yeah, there's a lot of big bummer stories. And I think even for people who there's not a specific tale of privacy lost, there is a sense that they don't like having their every click tracked and quantified, particularly considering, as we have seen in the last several days, massive changes to how this country is working with executive orders.
This is amazing. This is big. How long is this going to go on?
Okay, so it's all next week. Mm-hmm. Every single day, we sort of start with a topic. Day one is with cryptographer Bruce Schneier. He explains what your phone knows, and we dive into the settings on your phone, and then we take it through the week, where on the last day, we are with Sir Tim Berners-Lee, and we write together our own personal terms of service, how we want to live on the web going forward. And I think you would agree, John, there is no more urgent a time to do this than now.
Manu Zamarodi, host of Note to Self, be a part of the privacy paradox. Sign up this week, and it starts on Monday.
That's right.
Janine from Blanchard, Oklahoma.
No, man, calling from Charlottesville.
Liz Bradley, and I'm calling from Surfside Beach in South Carolina.
Gail from Portland, Oregon.
I am definitely concerned about my privacy in this new Trump banning era.
I use VPNs on all my devices and do a weekly scan for viruses and malware.
I don't have Facebook on my cell phone, and I don't use unsecured networks for banking online.
I have to confess that I don't give it a huge amount of thought.
I find digital privacy to be very concerning because I do a lot of my bill paying and shopping online.
Ever since the Patriot Act, I do not even believe in privacy.
I now only use end-to-end encryption on all of my mobile communications, and I plan to switch to the Tor internet browser.
And I encourage all my friends and family to use passwords on all their devices, not just numbers or fingerprints, but full letter, number, and symbol passwords.
Tips from you to protect your privacy. Tell us anything at all that you do. Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or on the Takeaways Facebook page. And if you just don't know where to start, check out Note to Self's Privacy Paradox. President Donald Trump's executive order banning refugees from Muslim-majority countries from entering this country for 4 months includes a confusing reference to exclude minority religions from the ban, something Trump himself addressed when he said that Christian refugees from some of those Muslim countries have been horribly treated. Among the Christian voices outraged by an order favoring one religion over another is the faith-based Church World Service, a humanitarian service organization that helps refugees immigrate and resettle in the United States. Jennifer Smyers is the Director of Policy and Advocacy for the Church World Service's Immigration and Refugee Program.
The Refugee Resettlement Program and all of the work for Church World Service is done for many, many different religions. There are Christian, Jewish, Muslim, Hindu, Sikh individuals who come to the United States through the Refugee Resettlement Program, and as well as Buddhists, etc. And so we are unequivocally opposed to this executive order and any policy that gives preference to religious minorities or people of certain religions at the expense of others. We actually just came out with a letter with more than 2,000 religious leaders opposing this policy and any policy that would preference Christians at the expense of Muslims who are seeking safety.
Would you say there's a consensus among churches in the United States on precisely that issue, that singling out a particular religion is against anything that any of these churches would support?
Yes, I would. And I think that many religions and scriptures are completely clear that we should love our neighbor as ourself, that we should welcome the stranger. I mean, I think you can probably find people who are religious who are going to have different opinions about this. But when you look at religious traditions across the board, people are very opposed to this. Even Orthodox Christian communities in Syria and in the Middle East are diametrically opposed to any policy that gives preference to Christians for many reasons, including the fact that by the U.S. signaling that we will only let in Christians, we're actually putting a target on the back of Christians in the Middle East who might face retribution as a consequence.
So you're doing this as a way of implementing U.S. policy. I mean, the U.S. doesn't do the resettlement itself. It creates a policy of resettlement, but then has you carry it out, right?
Well, that's right. We work in partnership with local communities across the country and with the U.S. State Department and Office of Refugee Resettlement. So it is a public-private partnership. But you're absolutely right. Resettlement is the implementation of U.S. foreign policy. And this announcement really sets us back in terms of our leadership around the globe when it comes to human rights, when it comes to refugee protection, and really just when it comes to our leadership and respect on the global stage.
Well, more particularly, it makes you the face of a policy that you have described as shameful. You're carrying it out.
Well, we're committed to making sure that refugees can come and seek safety in the United States. Right now, we're having to carry out the implementation of an executive order by making sure that families who will be barred because of this executive order know what to expect and can make the best decisions for themselves and their families. But, I mean, make no mistake, we're incredibly opposed to this executive order, and we're working with members of Congress and others to raise up opposition. I think that there's a lot of work that we need to continue to do to lift up opposition to this.
But an executive order is an executive order, and even though the president has described there will be some modifications, perhaps, and Congress has suggested it needs to be reworked, you have no power over that. Until that happens, you're standing with your hands in your pockets, essentially the face of a policy that really puts you in a, it seems to me, a humiliating light.
I think that's correct. And I think that it's really a shameful day in American history when the president of the United States is going to drastically change U.S. foreign policy and U.S. refugee policy. And at the forefront, you're right, are organizations like mine that are faith-based organizations having to tell people that they cannot seek safety, even though we promised that to them and their families.
Any examples of where you had to do exactly that?
Yeah, we have hundreds of stories across the country of individuals. We have 212 individuals who were set to come this week. 164 of them are family reunification cases. Personally, myself, I am friends with a woman. Her name is Mathak, and she's a refugee from Iraq. She lives in Knoxville, Tennessee, and her husband and their two small children entered the United States 5 months ago. But their two twin daughters, who are are 18 years old are still in Iraq due to processing delays with their visa. And because of this ban on those seven nationalities, which includes Iraq, they are incredibly traumatized and trying to figure out how they can make sure that their twin daughters are in a safe place while they await what is now, you know, a 90-day ban and could be even longer.
And you had to deliver that news.
That's correct. It's an incredibly trying and heartbreaking time for these families.
Worst day of your professional life?
Absolutely, without a doubt.
Jennifer Smyers, Director of Policy and Advocacy for the Immigration and Refugee Program of the Church World Service, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for covering this. It's so important.
Back now to the Heartland voices we heard at the top of the program. Next door to our Oklahoma farmers, an elderly Nebraska gentleman working well past retirement age, he's 86, starts his day at his local McD's.
He drives through McDonald's, gets his breakfast.
I'll have a sausage McMuffin with egg and cheese.
Okay, $2.95.
Goes to the office, sits at his desk all day with CNBC on the television. And when the phone rings, he takes a call, but he reads the entire day. The only thing that's changed since I was five is that we have computers now, so he does go home and play bridge on the computer. And he'll play bridge sometimes till 2 or 3 in the morning, and it's pretty much the same every day.
He's loving it all, his $3 McMuffin, his computer bridge game, and says his daughter being productive, a Heartland value, in this case, worth $73 billion. And you can get a taste of that Heartland value watching Becoming Warren Buffett this week on HBO, how a little boy from Omaha, son of a salesman, grew up to take over a struggling textile firm to make Berkshire Hathaway a global business legend.
My dad had various nicknames for me. He'd call me Fireball sometimes because I'd start little businesses. He didn't care about money at all. He believed very much in having an inner scorecard and to never worry about what other people are thinking about you. You know, just if you know why you're doing what you're doing, that's good enough.
Susan A. Buffett, Warren's daughter, says her dad agreed to do this movie because he didn't really want to write a memoir. But he did want people to know that money, even great gobs of it, is not the point of Buffett's still tied to the Heartland life.
You know, when you do what he loves and you do it as well as he does it, you end up with a whole bunch of money. But that's not the goal for him. The goal for him is doing it as, you know, as well as he can and better than most other people. And then the byproduct is all this money, which, you know, as everyone knows now, he's just trying to get rid of.
His dad was a salesman, and the DNA of sales is sort of partly what's responsible for, business success,
yeah,
being able to understand that. But we wouldn't say that Warren Buffett is a salesman in the classic sense. It's almost as though he's taken the skeleton of salesmanship and found a kind of deeper meaning, a deeper understanding there. What do you think's going on?
Yeah, I don't think he's a salesman at all, because he wouldn't want to be talking people into doing anything that they didn't want to do themselves. And when he started the partnership years ago, you know, he did start with some money from family members. And I think, honestly, what happened inside him then was he had such a huge feeling of responsibility for those people that he cared about to do a good job. He did want to be left alone to do his thing and to be trusted. But he also, the integrity goes further with him than anybody I know, I think. And he felt so responsible for those people. But I would never, you know, if you said you have to describe your dad with 500 different words, salesman wouldn't be number 500.
How does the success go along with the ruthlessness and qualities of single-mindedness and even narcissism that we associate with American capitalism, and say someone like a Donald Trump, who's now president of the United States?
He's a pretty humble, you know, regular guy, but he's competitive and he's focused. He's obviously extremely smart and very good at what he does, but, you know, there's no narcissism with him. That's not who he is.
How does your father handle adversity, and how is that shown in the film?
He's pretty resilient. And, when you say adversity, I think the most adversity he's had in his life has been the death of his father, the death of my mother moving. And he is good at compartmentalizing and going back and focusing. I do say in the movie that I thought I wasn't sure he'd get out of bed after my mother died. But, you know, he did. And he has a way of just turning it back to the work and focusing. And I think he deals with adversity by sitting in his office and working.
Is he a lucky man?
Yeah, I think he's lucky. I mean, he would say he was lucky to be born to the parents he was born to in this country and to be wired the way he was wired to be good at what he's, you know, at good at what he's good at. But he certainly has also worked hard. He's earned every penny he's earned by working very hard. But I certainly think he would say he won the ovarian lottery, as he frequently talks about. And I think that's a lot of luck.
Do you think the way in which he's preserved his values and traditions and maintained his lifestyle is a form of investing in America, which is what he talks about a lot, that it's a sticking with something that he believes has real value?
I don't know that he would think about it that hard. It's where he's comfortable. He is, you know, he could do anything he wanted to do. He would say he's happy in the same house he's been. He's happy, you know, taking the great-grandchildren and the grandchildren to Dairy Queen once a month for lunch. You know, he'd be happy driving the same car he had 50 years ago, but that isn't the case. But he's doing what he likes to do, and it's just really who he is.
Why do he and Bill Gates get along?
Oh, they're very similar in a lot of ways, and I think that's it. I mean, he and Bill, it's funny, when they first met, Bill had no interest in meeting him because he couldn't imagine what they would have in common. And then, of course, they met and they were like two little magnets almost. You know, they're super smart. It starts with that, I think. But they also, there's a lot of humor, I think, between the two of them when they get together. And, you know, they have a lot in common to talk about. And they're interested in the same things. And, of course, my dad has gotten more and more into the Giving Pledge work and the philanthropy work. And Bill is, you know, really great at that. And they have a lot to talk about.
Donald Trump embodies this idea of riches and power, but it seems that your father embodies a different notion, riches and responsibility.
Yes.
How does he articulate that, if he does?
I mean, I think it's more in his actions than actually what he says. You know, first of all, nobody would believe the way he actually lives. You know, he lives in the same house we grew up in, and it's a nice house, but he's there, he's happy, he isn't buying a bunch of material things. And my mother was so into social justice and civil rights. And he was right there behind her. He was at the office, but he was right there with her philosophically and backed her up in everything she did. And he saw so much how unfair and unjust so many things are in this country and around the world. I just think he thinks it would be wrong if we weren't all trying to do something to make the world better.
Is there a quality to Warren Buffett that will go with him, that will pass? What are the simple qualities that you'll miss about him?
Well, the first word that comes to mind is integrity. He set such a wonderful example for all of us, and my mother did too when we were kids, of just being an honest, good person who finds value in everyone and feels that, you know, we're all here on equal footing and here to do what we can for each other. You know, my mother says in the film, there's no finer human being. And, you know, my dad just has a lot of very good, it's not about the money at all with him. And, you know, that's, I hope, what comes through in the film too.
I think this film is, you know, is meaningful in ways that people will be surprised by.
I agree. I hope so.
Thanks so much, Susie.
Thank you.
Becoming Warren Buffett is airing on HBO. Here's something to take with you today. Representing even more billions than Warren Buffett is worth, representatives of big pharmaceutical companies appeared with President Trump at the White House while he signed executive orders sweeping away regulations that he says slows approval of new drugs. After saying during the campaign that drug companies were getting away with murder, he vowed this more corporate, favorable Food and Drug Administration would bring expensive drugs down. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. Learn more at TIAA.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.